All right, we're beginning here on the bottom of Mem Daled Amud Bet by the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, "Hayerachok mi beit haskila arba amot." When he was 4 amot away from the place of execution, mafshitin oto et bigadav. We strip him down, take off all of his clothing. We are going to discuss in the Gemara we already did before, bring this limo down, that it's oto, that when he's stoned, it's him that is stoned and nothing else. That's why we remove the clothing from him. Aish mechasin oto milafanav. The man we cover up from in front, we give him a loincloth to cover himself up. Aisha milafanav umiachara. And the woman we cover up on both sides, divrei Rabbi Yehuda. Chachamim omrim, haish niskal arum, ve'enan isha niskalat aruma. That and the Chachamim believe that the requirement to stone without any clothing on is only a requirement with regards to a male, not with regards to a female. And again, the Gemara will discuss the limudim of each position. Now the Gemara says, Tanu Rabbanan, haish mechasin oto perek echad milefanav, v'isha shnei perakim. So the way that Rashi explains it over here is, klomer ma'at. Perek echad means a small amount, and he says that we use some sort of loincloth to cover him up, which he says in Old French is torinchin, or maybe trunks, is maybe the word that Rashi is using over here. On the other hand, the woman, Isha, shnei prakim, we have her have 2 pieces of cloth, ben milafanah, ben milachareha, b'pnei shekula erva, because her erva is exposed from both sides, both from the front and the back would be exposed, so we cover her up from both sides, divrei Rabbi Yehuda. That's the position of Rabbi Yehuda, which is reflective of what we saw in the Mishnah in the position of Rabbi Yehuda. Chachamim arim, ha'ish niskal arum, ve'ein ha'isha niskalat aruma. This is only true by a man, that he is naked when he is stoned. That is not true by a woman. Mai taimayu derabanan. What's the reasoning behind the Rabbanan's position? Damakra viragamu oto. That he is stoned. Mai oto. Ilema oto velo ota. If you say that it means that he is stoned and she is not stoned, v'achtiv, otseit et ha'isha hu. The pasuk makes it clear that the application here, in terms of skila and in terms of the death penalty, is similar both between man and a woman. There is no reason to differentiate between man and woman, meaning lo shnahu, lo shnahi, that we treat men and women equally in this scenario in terms of their culpability as well as the death penalty. Elamai oto. So what does oto come to teach you? Oto balok suto ha ota bik suta. Teaches you that he goes naked without his ksut. That's the oto. Oto, he is stoned, but not his clothing. Whereas she, hota biksuta, she does have her clothing on. Now the Baal Yeh Tosafot say, lav mikra dorish. This is not learning it out of the pasuk. Tahaleka miut. There is no miut over here, because we need the drusha of oto to teach you he is stoned without his clothing on. So you can't use it for both drushot. You can't say it means him and not his clothing, and then it also means him and not her. Rather, there's a logical reason why they're going to say in a minute that they believe there should be a differentiation between the man and the woman. So even though it sounds from the Gemara that they are darshaning oto velo ota, Tosafot says that's not the drush over here, but rather the drush is that he is stone naked without his clothing. It should have been applicable to the woman, but we don't apply it to her, and that will be explained further in a minute. Rav Yehuda omer, oto belo ksuto, Loshna ish, loshna isha, means that there's no differentiation. The parshia is written for both men and women. When it's written in the male form, it's just to cover both, because when you have both male and female, you conjugate in the male form. And so the fact that it says oto is not exclusive to ota, but rather simply telling you the drasha, that oto belok suto, you stone him, not with his clothing on, and the same thing is equally applicable to a woman. B'memra, terabonan chayshe l'yuhura. So from this, you would conclude that the Rabbanan are worried about stoning the woman naked because they're worried about people seeing the woman naked and that creating a problem of hirhur, of improper thoughts being developed afterwards. For Rabbi Yehuda lo chayish lehirhura. And Rabbi Yehuda does not worry about hirhur. Va'ipchash manaluhu. We heard the opposite in their positions. It's not. We have a Mishnah in Sota. Ha'kohen ochez bibigadeha. The Kohen holds on to her clothing. Im nikre'u, nikre'u. If they rip, they rip. Im nifrimu, nifrimu. Rashi interprets the difference between prima and kriya is, prima is like it's torn into tatters, whereas kriya is a straight line. It's a straight tear. Nifrimu means it's just ripped in all different directions and places. It's more like it's in tatters rather than ripped. On the other hand, the Ramban explains the difference between kriya and prima is that kriya is ripping the beged, prima is ripping it along the seams. So if it rips, it rips. Ad shemegale liba, until it exposes her heart. Besoter et sara, and we undo the braids of her hair, we expose her hair as well. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, if she was a pretty woman, then we don't expose it. If she had beautiful hair, we do not unwind it. Meaning that, first of all, we'll give her a certain amount of confidence. If she has this beauty, it might make her more resilient to resisting admitting that she's done something wrong. As well as the fact that we are worried about the Kohanim that are working with this woman. If she's beautiful, then they might start to have hiruhurim or improper thoughts because they're seeing this woman whose chest is now being exposed and her hair is being exposed. Hamaraba, there's a difference. Hatam hainu taima. What's the reason by sota? Shema teitze bibetin zaka'a. Because maybe she will be found not guilty. She'll be found innocent of the charges that have been brought against her that she had some infidelity in her marriage. And then the young Kohanim will either be making fun of her or will be drawn after her and have their yetzer be ignited by that. Hacha ha-mikatla. Over here, there's nothing to worry about because she's going to be killed. She's not going to be around afterwards. So maybe the problem is we'll have the transference of the Yerhurim. She may not be around anymore, but they're seeing her in her naked state will then have them project those feelings or those thoughts onto another woman. Amarabo Gemire, we have a Misora. The Yetzirah only affects people when they can see that individual, when they're able to place the image together with the individual who the image is about. And so there's no transference or projection of the image from the woman onto another woman. And therefore we don't worry about that issue of Yetzirah. So over here we have Rabba making a distinction between the case in Sota, where there's a possibility that the woman will be found innocent and survive the ordeal. Versus the case here where she's going to be put to death and she will not survive the ordeal. Amarova, the Rabbi Yehuda, the Rabbi Yehuda kasha, the Rabbanan lo kasha. So Rava says, Rabbi Yehuda is a stira, and that you're trying to explain, but the Rabbanan is not a stira. The Rabbanan have the same problem. How are you going to explain the differentiation in the Rabbanan's position? You explain why Rabbi Yehuda worries about the Yetzer Hara by Sota and not by the case of killing her, but you don't explain the Chachamim's position where they don't worry about it by Sota, and they do worry about it by the case of killing. Ela Amarava, the Rabbi Yehuda, the Rabbi Yehuda lo kasha. Rabbi Yehuda's positions are not a stira, kiddushanin, like we just learned, like we just explained, like Rabba told us. Rabbana, the Rabbana nami lo kasha. The Rabbana are also not a stira. Amakra, because the pasuk says, vinivasru kol anashim, lo tasena kazimat chena. Because the women will all take a lesson. They will learn from what's happening to this woman, and they will not do like your infidelity or your adultery. So what they're trying to do here is make an example out of this woman. And as Rashi notes over here, and it's an important fact in the case, is that even if the woman is found to be innocent, she's not completely innocent. She's innocent of the final charges, which are the fact that she had an adulterous affair. But this woman, in order to be accused of being a sota, has to have done many things that are circumstantial evidence towards the fact that she is guilty here. And that is that her husband warned her not to isolate herself or be yichud with this individual. Despite those warnings, she went ahead and was miyetiachedet. She was alone with this man, secluded in a place. So she violated the request of her husband. Not only violated, did it in a way that was indicative of promiscuous behavior, where she is now alone together with this man. And, okay, in the end, she didn't commit adultery, but there's a serious issue where her behavior is somewhat problematic. So therefore, we don't worry about her kavod in the end, because she's already quasi-guilty of behavior that is inappropriate. And so therefore, we want to make an example out of this woman, so that other women will think twice about acting in this way or behaving in this manner. And therefore, the Rabbanon permit the, in a sense, denigrating of the woman, exposing her, even though there is a risk of hiruhurim with regards to Kohanim. We still see the overarching principle here of setting an example of this woman so that others will not follow in her footsteps, being important enough that this will dissuade others from acting in this way. Hacha, ein lecha yisur gadol mizeh. Over here, there's no bigger lesson. She's going to be put to death in the end. You don't need her to be denigrated any greater fashion that she has to be naked. So why not do both? You're already going ahead and she's going to be put to death. Why not also have her be naked so that other people will take a lesson from this and it will be an extreme lesson. So fine, death, yes, is obviously something, but death with nakedness would be even more of a deterrent. So Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rav Ravua, Amar Kra, Bahafta Reacha Kamocha, that you have to treat your fellow Jew like you would want yourself treated. Bror lo mita yafa. Choose for them the best death. So this is very interesting. Tosafot over here goes out of his way to try to justify or explain why the application of Vahafta Reacha Kamocha is really about death. And that is, he gives two possibilities. One is that we have the principle that Rabbi Akiva gives us, which is Chayecha Kodmim, that when it comes to a choice between your life and the life of your friend, your life always takes precedence. And so therefore you can't say Vahafta Reacha Kamocha when you're alive. So maybe the only place that it's applicable is in death, to say Vahafta Reacha Kamocha. That's one way that he says it. The other way he says it is the beginning of the Pasuk in Vayikra is Lo tikom velo titor. Do not take revenge. Do not be spiteful. Vahafta Reacha Kamocha. And Tosfo points out from the Psukim that we see that there's a cherev nokemet, that you have a sword or death is associated with nekama. And so the Pasuk, or the context of the Pasuk, is death. And that makes it applicable, that Vahafta Reacha Kamocha is applicable to death. And in that way, the Gemara darshins over here, Vahafta Reacha Kamocha is bror lo mita yafa, that you have to give the best option in terms of the death penalty here. Lema, the Rav Nachman Tanaihi. If you say that, then Rav Nachman's principle is actually a makloket Tanaim between the Rabbanan and Rabbi Yehuda as to whether we apply it by death. Where it says, look, the Kuliyama eat lo the Rav Nachman. Everybody subscribes to Nachman. V'hocha b'haka miflige. This is the makloket. Marsavar bizyone d'inish adifaleit vei minecha d'gufei. That a person would rather save themselves the embarrassment, even though it might cause them more pain. And Marsavar necha de gufe adif mizune, that the saving of the pain or the anguish that they will undergo is better than the embarrassment that they might suffer. Here you have a challenge, which is that you have competing interests here. If the person is unclothed, they are more likely to die quickly. The impact of everything that's going to be done, the severity and the impact will be much more pronounced if they're not wearing clothing. So in terms of dying or the death penalty, it'll be easier if they're not wearing the clothing. On the other hand, without wearing clothing is embarrassing, and there'll be embarrassment suffered. So now you have a challenge here. Which is better? Which do people prefer? Would they prefer to undergo embarrassment in order to expedite the death? Or would they rather have slightly slower death, but not have to suffer the embarrassment? And that's what the Chachamim are saying. Chachamim are saying, V'hafta l'reacha kamocha, that you have to choose the best death for this individual. And in that way, just like other people would not want to be embarrassed, so to over here, you want to protect the woman from that embarrassment. And in protecting her from that embarrassment, yes, it might lead to a slightly slower death, but that is the trade-off that people will make or will want to make. And so therefore, you will treat them in the way that you would want to be treated, which is that you will protect them from the embarrassment, even though it's a slightly slower death. Rabbi Yehuda says, no. V'haftarecha kamocha brodo mita yafa. Pick the most expeditious death penalty, because people would rather not suffer or have that pain, and even though they have to undergo some embarrassment to get there, it's worthwhile to do so. And so that's the explanation of their machloket. And now, you have to go back and explain what the Tosfot says. The reason the Chachamim say that oto velo ota is either because of bizyona, the embarrassment that she would suffer, and Vahafta L'reacha Kamocha says don't let her suffer that embarrassment, or hirhura, the problem of improper thoughts that might derive from it. So the Chachamim say that a woman may not be stoned naked because of those two reasons, and therefore we protect the woman's dignity at the expense of it being slightly slower, her death, because that's Vahafta L'reacha Kamocha. That's the best way to deal with it, and the way that other people would want to be dealt with, and therefore we apply it to this situation and the death penalty as well. The reason we don't strip the person down, even though the Pasuk says, oto velo biksuto, is because by the woman, we have these other factors that trump the necessity of the Pasuk to be naked in the death sentence of the individual. And that again is bizyona or hirhura. On the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda believes that the Pasuk dictates no differentiation between man and woman. And therefore, if it says the man is stone naked, the woman is stone naked. What about the other issues that the Chachamim raise? First of all, he says, in terms of embarrassment, a person would rather die quickly with less pain than worry about the embarrassment. So there's the application of the Reacha Kamocha leads you in the other direction. Number two is, Bizyuna and Hirhura are not an issue here, because Iror is only applicable when the woman's going to be around afterwards. Over here, the woman's not going to be around afterwards, and therefore, there's no worry about Hirhur. As opposed to the case of Sota, where by Sota, the woman will be around afterwards, and that Hirhur will be problematic, and that's why we want to prevent it. The Chachamim, on the other hand, say that we have an overarching theme of Nivasru Kol HaNashim, that other women will take a lesson from this, and that is more important than the possibility of Hirhur that might come out of this situation. Now, what comes out of Rabbah's statement here is something that has actually halachic implications. Because Rabbah says, Gemire, that we have this, Sora, Eina Yitzara Shaleta del Bimisha Eina Vroot. Only if you see the woman, will the improper thoughts be triggered. Tosfot already asks from the Gemara in Megillah, that says, Kol Omer Rachav Rachav Miad Nikri, that anybody who says Rachav's name automatically has a seminal omission. Gemara over there says, I mentioned her name and nothing happened. So the Gemara says that Hatam Bioda Umakira. It's when you know her and you recognize her. I mean that you've seen her. You've engaged with her. So the Baal Yotos Tosafot over here also add in an additional factor, which is that in order for there to be improper thoughts or things to derive from it, you have to have seen the woman. The mind or the imagination which extrapolates to these improper thoughts only works when the eyes have engaged somehow. This is very important because a lot of people don't focus on this. What does it matter what I see? What does it matter if I see it? But once the image is imprinted in the individual, then the imagination or the mind of the individual is able to take that image and then twist it or do all the machinations that the mind does with such images. If a person never engages with the image, it's much easier to distance oneself or disengage from these items. And that happens to be the problem that many experts speak about in terms of people on the internet getting involved with pornography. The difficulty of separating or getting away from it is because when a person already engaged through sight, it's very hard then to remove or distance oneself from it. It almost becomes into an addictive quality. And so therefore, sight or seeing is a significant impact on the individual. We say it every day in the third parshiyah of Kriyat Shema, Lo tatur acharei levavchem acharei einechem, that the lev is triggered by the einayim. And the einayim are an important factor here. So Tosfot over here gives us one issue, which is that you have to have seen the individual in order for it to have an impact. That's number one. And number two is that Rabbah says that any Yitzhak Shalet, it'll be Shein of Rot. The imagination is then only re-triggered when one sees that woman again, or that image comes back to the individual, not when it's looking at someone else or another woman. People don't project the image from one to the other. That has implications in issues of Kol Isha. And that is that the Poskim, in speaking about Kol Isha, say that if a person has not seen the woman who is singing, then the problems of Kol Isha may not exist. And that has implications for radio. Truthfully, the original Tshuvot were written about the phonograph, about records, and then obviously later about tapes, and then over the radio, which is that if a person hears a woman singing on the radio, if they have never seen an image of the woman, that doesn't matter whether they've seen her in person or they've seen a picture of the individual, either one of those would then preclude the individual from hearing the music because Kol Bisha Erva. And if you have the image of the woman already imprinted on your mind, then the association of the voice to the image will happen. But if you've never seen the woman, if you have no idea who this woman is or what she looks like, then listening to the music, the Kol Bisha Erva will not apply there because you can't see. And the mind will not then attach the voice to a persona or person in which it will create improper thoughts. And for that reason, Rav Avadya Yosef, and there are many poskim that follow this approach, say that if you hear singing on the radio, if you have no idea who the woman is, if you've never seen the woman at all, then it's not an issue. If you have seen the woman, or you've seen pictures of the woman, now that they have labels on these records and tapes with pictures of the singers, once you've already had a picture, or seen the picture, or seen them on TV, any type of interaction has to be in person, then the Kol Bisha Erva becomes problematic. And so this sugya here in Sanhedrin is very pivotal in that discussion with regards to Kol Bisha Erva, as well as that heter that comes about from individuals. It's not enough that it's on the radio, it's not live, but Kol Bisha Erva applies as long as there can be, in the mind, the ability to connect between the voice and a picture or an image of the woman. And that's what Tosfot says over here, Biodao Makira, that he has to know the woman, recognize the woman, and that is what causes the problem later on even though she doesn't see her again, but he mentions her name, certain things will conjure up those thoughts or images again. And Kol Isha Erva is one of those issues. And so therefore, the heter is not just to hear any non-live woman. It's to hear a woman not live, as long as you don't know who the woman is, or you don't have any picture of the woman in your mind. All right, now the Mishnah continues and says, Beit Eskilaya gova shtei komot. The Beit Eskilah was two stories high. It's really two heights of a person high. Echad min ha'edim dochafo al motnav. So here, one of the edim pushes off the individual onto their loins. It's unclear in the Mishnah as to what exactly is being done here. Does it mean dochafo al motnav? He pushes him from his loins, which means that he pushes him from behind, off the high point. Or is dochafo al motnav mean that he pushes him so that he will land on his loins? Mean that he will land on his back. You could read there either way, and the Rishonim read it in both directions, that you have to push them off. Now, one aide out of the two aidim pushes them off, and then we're going to see the other aide participates in the other section here. It's not clear in the psukim or why it is that only one aide pushes them off, and rather than both aidim being involved, later on the Gemara will dashen why one of the aidim does the stoning part of it. But here we don't have any explanation as to why the pushing is done by one aide. Secondarily, the Tosfot says, how do you know that we push the person off first and then stone them? We're going to learn from the Psukim by Har Sinai that there's both this idea of pushing off of a high point as well as stoning involved in Skila. But in the order of the Psukim in Har Sinai, it's the opposite way around. Skila is done first, and then the pushing is done afterwards. The Baalei HaTosfot in the end say it's because we have the Skila associated with Mitah. That stoning is associated with death, and therefore we do the stoning later so that it'll be closer to the point of death. But otherwise, it's also not clear how the order comes about, although you could see logically why you would do it in this manner. So now, they push him off a high point, and then the individual goes flying down. Ne'pach alibo, if he falls down and lands face first, so again, if the way you read it before is that you're pushing him off so that he will land on his back, maybe you push him off backwards, or you push it off a way that he'll flip and land on his back. But if he was unsuccessful at doing that, and the person is now face down into the ground, hovchol matnav, you turn them over, so now they are face up. Rashi tells you why. Kashu mushkav pirkadan. When a person is pirkadan, which is face down, ho meguna yoter. It is inappropriate. It's a denigration of the individual, something that we don't need to do, causing them, if they're still alive, to suffer from that embarrassment. If they're not alive, again, there's no reason to be menavil the individual in such a way where they're face down into the ground. Rashi over here uses the term pirkadan, which, if you remember from the Gemara of Baba Batra, the Fayin Chet Amud Aleph, in the stories of Rabba Bar Bachana there, where he meets the Meitei Midbar who are lying pirkadan, the Rabbeinu Tam over there brings that story as a raya against Rashi's understanding of pirkadan in the Gemara in Brachot. Because the Maran Brachot says you can't say Kriyat Shema, you can't make Brachot Pirkadan. Rashi explains Pirkadan as being face down. Baalei HaTosafot, the Rabbeinu Tam, explains Pirkadan as being face up. So over here, Rashi uses the word Pirkadan in the way that he explains it, which means face down. But the Baalei HaTosafot think Pirkadan means face up, so we understand from the Mishnah what it means. Therefore, they would not use the word Pirkadan. Nevertheless, Rashi does use the word Pirkadan according to his Shita, which means face down. We turn him now face up. Vim Meitba. If the person dies from the fall, yatsa, then you're yotze the mitzvah of skila. Vim lav. If not, hasheni notela to evan. The other aide takes the stone, vinotno alibo, and places it down on his heart. Placing here doesn't mean to place it, it means to drop it down on his heart. We'll see later on in the Gemara, it's a heavy stone. Imate va, yatsa. If they die from that, fine. Vim lav. If not, rigimato b'chol Yisrael. Then the rest of Klal Yisrael stones them. The Edim will be the first ones to execute the death penalty. And then the nation will follow up to ensure the death of the individual. The Rambam in Hilchot Sanhedrin explains why the Edim are the ones that have to execute over here. And that goes to the question that you asked, which Edim we're speaking about. We're speaking about the Edim that testified to the fact that this person violated a capital crime. And based on their testimony, we've now found the person guilty. These are the people that witness this individual violating something that they are culpable on a capital basis to suffer the death penalty for. So these Edim that caused us to proclaim a verdict of guilty and have this person be put to death and executed, they are the ones that have to actually execute on it. Now, the Rambam gives a reason. You could understand why even without the Rambam's reasoning, which is that we want the Edim to be involved because we want, if these Edim are lying, we want them to have to be actively involved in the killing of the individual so that they don't think, ah, yeah, we just testified. What did we do? No, they didn't just testify. You are going to put this individual to death, and you're going to be responsible for his death if you are lying. To make that more pronounced, to make that more realistic, the Edim have to be the ones that kill this person. And so that would make it that people will be less likely to lie, because their lying just doesn't lead to something that happens outside of them. It leads to something where they're going to have to put this person to death by their own hands. So that's a deterrent from lying when you are testifying. But the Rambam brings a second reason, which is the people who are certain about the requirement for an execution over your death penalty are the Edim. They're the ones who saw it. And we know the principle, seeing is believing. They witnessed it in person. The rest of us only heard it from the Edim. They testified to it. So we know about the information because of their testimony. But they know about it because they actually witnessed it. So they are the most certain about the guilt of this individual. And therefore, they appropriately are the first ones, or the first in line to kill them, because they are the ones who saw it and witnessed it. That's what the Rambam says. And that's why the Edim are the active participants in the execution of the individual. Tana, v'koma shalo. You have the height of the individual. We said it was shtei komot. It was two stories high. And then you have the height of the individual, harikan shalosh. That means that it's, quote-unquote, three stories high, or really it means the three heights of a person high. Umi bi'inan kule high. Do we really need so much height for a person to die? V'reminu, ma borshu k'de lamit asarat fachim. Av kol k'de lamit asarat fachim. In the Gemara in Baba Kama, in discussing a bor b'shut rabim, over there, the Gemara differentiates between a boar that is 10 tfachim deep, which has the capacity to kill, versus a boar that is 9 tfachim deep, which only has the capacity to injure and not to kill. And so we see from there that asarat tfachim is sufficient to kill an individual. So why are you going up 3 stories high when all you need is 10 tfachim to create a killer boar? Meaning a fall of 10 tfachim is sufficient to kill the individual. So why are we going all through all this trouble to make it much higher up? Now, the truth is that the psukim and the limud there in the Gemara Baba Kama is about animals. That animals that fall into a bor, if it's 10 tefachim deep, it's possible they could die from it. If they die, you'll be responsible. If it's 9 tefachim deep, then they can be injured but not killed. And if they die, you'll be patur, because that's not a killer bor. So it's only speaking about animals. The Baal Tosafot say that it has equal application to people because of the limud there. The limud there says, shor v'lo adam, chamor v'lo kelim. That you're only responsible for the death of a shor that falls into a boar, but not for an adam, a person that falls into a boar. So the reason you are patur over there is because of the gzera takatub. Gzera takatub says, shor, animal, you are chayav, adam, you are not chayav. But implicit in that is that the boar has the capacity to kill both a shor and adam. The only reason you're patur is because the pasuk says, shor and not adam. Had it not been for the pasuk, it would be equally capable of killing the person. So that's how we extrapolate the din from animal to man. And see over here, why are we going up to such heights when all you need is 10 tfachim? So Gemara says, I'm Rav Nachman, Rav Baravu, I'm a Kra. This is Rav Nachman's statement that we saw before. V'hafta l'reacha kamocha, that you have to love your fellow Jew, bror lo mita yafa. You have to pick the best death for him. Ihachi. If that's the case, l'gbei tfei. Then move it up much higher. Because if you want certainty of death, the higher you are, the more certain the death will be. So if you want to ensure that the person dies quickly and we'll call it quote-unquote painlessly, then the higher you go, the more likely that will be carried out. So why are you only going up 3 stories? Go up 10 stories when you do that. Because the body then will break apart. If you push the person off from much higher heights, when the body impacts on the ground, it'll, we'll call it explode, it will break apart, and that'll be something that is not kavod hamate in a sense, or kavod for the individual. It's an unnecessary thing to do. You don't gain that much by going up higher, but you then end up with this almost denigration or disregard for the body, and that we don't want to do. So Bahavdarecha Kamocha says, pick something that gives you sufficient height, that the certainty of death exists, or almost certain death exists, but not so high that the body is going to break apart. And so in that way, we pick this height of 3 stories high. The truth is that you could differentiate between a bor and the case here of skila, which is that Rashi over here says that a bor a standard bore is 10 tefachim deep, or a standard bore that kills is 10 tefachim deep. The Rabbeinu Tam, on the other hand, says, Mefresh to Rabbeinu Tam, the stam bore have a yoter masara. A default bore is more than 10 tefachim deep. So Rashi claims that the default bore is 10 tefachim deep, and that's what causes killing. The Rabbeinu Tam says that's just not true. Most borot are much deeper, and he brings evidence from Psukim and Tanakh that seem to indicate that the bore is significantly deeper. He says the default bore is much deeper. The Chachamim tell us that even though it's only 10 tefachim deep, it still has the capacity to kill. But that doesn't mean that your regular bore is 10 tefachim deep. It just says to us that the possibility of death exists when it is only 10 tefachim deep, but not that your standard bore is 10 tefachim deep. Now that also, again, here has certain implications, which is the difference between the bore of 10 tefachim and the case here is by the case of bore tefachim, it has the capacity to kill a 10 tefachim, but doesn't have the certainty of killing a 10 tefachim. Over here, we're trying to create a situation in which we want certainty of death and not just the capacity to kill. And so therefore, the difference between bore and the case here is that bore, we are looking at the capacity to kill. Over here, we're looking at about the certainty to kill. And that's why you have a differentiation in the height of the location where they push him off from for the execution, the death sentence or the execution versus the case of boar, where we just want to know that is the person culpable because he created something that could kill. And therefore, if an animal dies there, then he will be responsible for it. Now, that distinction might be exactly what the Gemara is trying to figure out here. If the boar can kill, then why isn't that the guideline for the death penalty? If the death penalty is looking for certainty of death, why aren't you then dropping the person or pushing him off from a much higher location? Because even in this situation that we're creating where it's much higher than the boar, you're not ending up with a certainty of death. Because if you say that it's two komot, literally the height of a person high, then you have a high likelihood that they might survive the drop. Now, if you say it's two stories or three stories high, then you have more of a chance that it actually will end up in a death. But in either case, you're not going to end up with certainty. And if you're not going for certainty, then boar should be the definition by 10 tefachim. If you're going for certainty, you should be higher. That's what the Gemara answers, v'hafta l'reicha kamocha. That even though it would make more sense to go higher to get the certainty of death, it is mitigated by the v'hafta l'reicha kamocha that we don't want the body breaking apart. So we want as close as we can to get to the certainty of death, but on the other hand, we don't want to do it in a way that's menavel the individual. And so that either means, based on what we saw in the Mishnah, three heights of the person, or three stories high, but that will get to us to a point where we have higher certainty of death vis-a-vis a boar, which is just possible to get killed there. But on the other hand, we will fulfill the obligation of Ahavta the Re'acha Kamocha. How do you know that we push somebody off a high location when it calls for skila, which is stoning? Talmud Lomar Yaro. By Har Sinai, it says Yaro. How do we know that that's associated, that there is skila? Talor sakol uminayin shib skila ubedichia. How do you know that both need to be meted out, both the pushing off and the skila? Tamalomar sakol yisakel o yaro yiyare. So over here you have multiple limudim that are coming out. The first one is that the lashon of yaro, which means like a projectile to be shot out, that's like being thrown out or projected out. That's where we learn out that the individual has to be pushed off, like yarabayam, that the person is thrown around or tossed around in the sea, in Az Yashir. So now, how do we know that the skila also requires actual skila? Because of the fact that it says sakol yisakel. And we know that skila or sakalua is associated with avanim in the Torah. So in the punishment for someone who violates the boundaries of Har Sinai, we see that they're going to be subject to yaro yira, and sakol yisakel. They'll be subject both to being shot out or thrown away, as well as stone. And so therefore, when we simulate that, when it comes to the killing of an individual, the skill of an individual, that punishment is reflective of both of those aspects, the b'chiyah, the pushing off, as well as the skila. The riboy that teaches us that it's not enough just to do one or the other, that you actually need both, is because of the riboy of the language, which is sakol yisakel yaro yireh. So that teaches us that it's not enough to do one, that you need to have both of them done. And that's the way that Rashi learns it over here. Each one of them teaches you that you have to do one of these items, and that is an O in between, one or the other. But then when you duplicate the language of sakol yisakel yaro yireh, that teaches you that not only you have to do one, you have to accomplish both of them to execute an individual is chayav skila. Uminayim she make mitchia yatsa. How do we know that if they die by the pushing off, that's enough? How do we know that you don't have to do both in order to kill them through both? Tamalomar o yaro yire. So the O in the middle allows you to say that if one of them is sufficient, then you are still yotze, even though both of them need to be carried out or should be carried out. Minayin she'af ledorot kein. So now you know that by Har Sinai, how do we apply that to outside of Har Sinai? Talomar sakol yisakel. Dashon atid. It is a future language. It doesn't say sakol sakol. Rashi says, oh, yaro yaro. It says sakol yisakel. They will be stoned, and yaro yire. So that there is both a present tense as well as a future tense associated with it. The truth is that the pasuk written by Har Sinai also involves a future tense because it's about the upcoming event that's going to take place. But Chazal read this future tense not being about the upcoming event, because that you could have written in the present, but rather it's about the future punishments that are going to be executed by Beit Din, that the application of that which was Har Sinai is also applicable here. So we learn out from Yaro and Sakel that there are two aspects to it. One is being projected out or thrown out. The other one is being stoned. We learn out from the double lashon of Sakol Yisakel Yaro Yire, teaches you that you have to do both and it's not sufficient to do one or the other. We learn from the O that if one of them succeeds at killing the individual, that is okay, and your yotze, the execution. And we learn out from the future language that is used there, the conjugation, the atid, that it applies not only to Har Sinai, but applies to all death sentences, executions that involve skila. Vimlav, Eda Sheni Notela to Evan. Notel, Vahatanya. How could he take the stone? Don't we have a brayta, Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar Omer, Evan Aita Sham, Masui Shnei Bnei Adam. There was a stone there by the point of execution, which was the weight that needs two people to lift it up. Notla, Vinotla, Alibo. You take it, and you place it on the heart of the individual. Again, not placing it, but dropping it or throwing it down. It made by yatsa, and if they die by it, you yotze. Guma says, "V'litamech tikshalach higufa." Wait a minute, how are you going to explain the brayta that you just brought from Bishimon? Brayta says it takes two people to lift up the stone, and then it says that the individual places it down in the singular. So why are you asking us about one aid doing it? The brayta itself indicates that it takes two people to lift it, and only one of them is putting it on the individual. So masui shnei ben adam, if it takes two people to lift it, no lav and no da alibo. How could they, one person, pick it up and then put it down on the individual, or throw it down on the individual? Ella, the madalei b'hadei chavrei, they raise it together. The two edim raise the stone together because the weight of the stone is so great that it takes two people to pick it up. V'shadi la'iu, and then the one aid is the one who pushes it down or throws it down. Keichi detete mrazio, that goes down in a directed fashion. Because when two people try to throw something together, they're in some type of ways working against each other. They're trying to coordinate with each other. It's very hard. So what we do is have them both lift it up. And then one of them, when they're releasing it, takes it and throws it down or smashes it down by himself. Because then he can direct it with full force on the individual. So again, here, when we're talking about stoning here, we're not talking about throwing little stones here. We're talking about a massive stone that is now going to be thrown down with pressure onto the individual. Because you can see why this would kill the individual. If they weren't already killed by being pushed off the high place, that this type of stone being thrown on the individual could have severe impact or cause the death of the individual, because you're talking about a heavy, heavy stone, requires two people to lift, and then one of the edim is now going to push it down with all of his force and direct it onto the individual. So that's why we have the one aid directed in the end in terms of the killing, and then in this way, both edim have a hand in the killing of the individual for the reasons that we discussed beforehand. All right, now, vim lav regimato, if not, then the whole nation stones him. Vatanya me'olam lo shana ba adam, that there was never a need for the nation to stone, that a person was always dead after the first two procedures, which is either being pushed off the high ledge or being stoned by this heavy stone of the one individual. Mika mina da avid, the mission is not saying that you do this. Ida mitzrach kamina, it says if you need it, then you do it. It's not saying that it's absolutely necessary, it's just saying that if the person doesn't die, then you have this other option in terms of continuing. Doesn't tell you that the person won't die. Doesn't tell you that it won't happen. our experience is that the person always dies after the first two stages. You never have to get to the third stage of the people stoning him. The Mishnah is just saying to you, if you do get there, that's what you would do. Amamar, Evan Aita. Now they're quoting from the Braita. They're going back and discussing this Braita that there was a stone that was kept there that required two people to lift it up. Vatanya, we just quoted this back with regards to the requirement to pay for the instruments of death. We quoted this Braita as well. Achat Evan Shiniskalba. The stone that was used to kill the individual, or the tree that was used to hang the individual, or the sword by which to behead them, or the handkerchief that is used to choke the individual, they are buried with the individual is being executed over here. So now, if they're buried, how can you say that there is this stone that is kept by the place of execution? Every time the stone is used, it's then buried with the individual. So then, how would you have a stone that is kept there? Lo, tzricha demetakne umaite achrina chilufayu. It's not that there is always one stone that they keep, the designated stone. Each time that they execute, then they bring a new stone to replace it, and it's kept there. They have a stone that requires two individuals to carry it. That would be appropriate for the stoning. So it's not that it's permanently there, the stone. It just means that every time they use the stone, they replace it. And then when they get there, there's that stone available to execute the next individual. Nikbarimimo. So Gemara says, you said that these items are buried with him. Batanyu and Nikbarimimo. We have a bright that says you don't bury the tools of the death with the individual. So Rapapa, my emo, what does it mean along with the individual? Imo betfisato means alongside the individual. Doesn't mean literally with the individual. Tfisato means the area that the mate grabs. And that is the four amot around the mate. We know that arba amot around a mate are considered to be the space of the mate, perimeter of where we consider it to be a part of his grave. And so therefore we bury it in that perimeter. Don't necessarily bury it directly with them, but we bury it alongside them. Amar Shmuel, so this goes to the question that you asked earlier on, nikta'a yad aidim patur. If one of the Edim loses an arm, then the execution is not carried out. Because we said, Yada Edim Tieh Bo Barishuna. The hands of the Edim have to be those that kill this individual. If the Ed is missing the arm, they can no longer carry out the execution. And the person is then not acquitted, but even though they were found guilty, they are released from the death penalty. My Taima, Dbinad Yada Edim Tieh Bo Barishuna Veleka. Because we need the Edim to be the first ones to execute this individual. And you don't have that in this case. Elimeato, if that's the case, Edim Gidmin, Dimikara, Edim who come when they testify don't have arms to start with, Hakanami de Psile, that we shouldn't accept them as Edim. Because if we accept them as Edim, we're not going to be able to render a guilty verdict that will come to an execution. So therefore, we're not going to accept Edim who don't have arms. Shani Hotom, it's different over there, the Kamakra, Yada Edim Shaita Kivar. So when we say Yada Edim Tiabo Barishona, that means that if the Edim, when they testified, had arms, then those arms must be used in the execution. And therefore, if the Ed loses his arm in the interim, then there is no execution, and the person then is let free or released. On the other hand, if the Edim, when they showed up in the first place, didn't have arms, then you can't demand that the execution be done with the arms that never existed. Or in essence, what we say is whatever they do to replace their arms, whether it's a prosthetic, whether it's whatever is left of their arm that they use to be their hands, that becomes the hand of the Edim. And that is what they're going to use. The same way that they function in life, that's how they're going to do or carry out the punishment of the individual. And therefore, Edim who never had arms are not disqualified from testifying. The only problem is if the Edim showed up with arms and then lost the arm afterwards, then we have a problem because then we can't fulfill Yad Edim Tieh Bo Barishona. Meitevei, kol makom shidu shnayim. V'yomru me'edim anu b'ish ploni, sh'nigmar dino b'beitin ploni uploni, uploni eidav, harizeh yareik. So if an individual left beitin, whether they ran away, or whether the other beitin wasn't able to carry out the execution, and these eidim now show up and say, we know this guy, he was found guilty in another court, and in that other court, these were the eidim, and we are testifying to the fact that he is deserving of a death penalty. The Gemara says here that the new court will take this individual and execute them based on the testimony of these two Edim. These two Edim that are telling us that there was already a verdict of guilty. There were other Edim that already were the Edim that saw the incident and incriminated this individual. That information itself is enough to put the person to death. So now the question the Gemara is asking is, wait, didn't you require Yad Edim Tiebo Barishona? That the Edim themselves must be the ones who execute. Over here, you have Edim who are going to execute, who are not the Edim who witnessed the event itself. And so how do you reconcile that? So Gemara says, Targum HaShmuel, Shmuel explains that bright, Behein Hein Edav, that the people coming and testifying now about the guilty verdict are the same Edim that witnessed the person violating the crime that resulted in their being found guilty. So that's how Shmuel explains the case. Now the truth is, you could argue that the two Edim now that are coming and say they had a guilty verdict are the ones that are subjecting him to the death penalty. And that it really is a fulfillment of Yad HaEdim Tiyah Bo Barishona. But what you see from here from the Gemara is that that is not enough. You want the Edim that actually saw it. And this might be the source for what the Rambam said before, that we want the Edim who actually witnessed the event to be the ones who kill him, because they are the most certain about the issue. And because of that, that's why this Gemara here insists that the Edim that are going to execute are the Edim who actually witnessed him doing the crime, and not Edim just know that he is guilty. And for that reason, the Gemara comes to a conclusion here that that Braita must be speaking about the original Edim who witnessed him doing the crime, are the ones also now testifying about the fact that he was found guilty in court. Mar says, the underlying assumption of all this Gemara is that we take Psukim literally. And is that really true? Do you really have to take Psukim literally? Don't we have a Braita? Motumat hamakeh rotzeachu, that the killer is put to death because he is a murderer. In the Elabit Mitak Tuvabo, person is put to death in the proper death that is associated with the crime that the person committed. A murderer is subject to hereg, to killing by the sword. Minayin shimi ata yochola amito b'mitak tuvabo, shata memito b'chol mitash ata yochola amito. How do I know that if we are unable or incapable of killing him by the death penalty that is prescribed by the Torah, that we end up killing him in any way possible? Tamalomar, mot yumat hamakeh, mikom makom. We want the person dead, irrespective of how death penalty is carried out. So it seems like, l'chadchilo, the Torah is telling you we want the death penalty to be such and such. But if you're unable to do that, we want the person dead. That's the most important thing. We want the murderer eliminated from the world. We want him taken away. That's our primary objective. The Torah prescribes the method for that. If we can do it that way, good. If we can't do it that way, we do it any way possible. What you see here is that we don't take the pasuk literally. We probably take the pasuk as a general instruction or guideline. We don't take it literally to the point where if we don't have that, then we won't accept that as the death penalty. Where it says, Shiny hotam damakra motumat. The pasuk there has a specific riboy. So where it says, Veligmor mine, let us extrapolate from that. Let us use that as a paradigm and extrapolate to the rest of the Torah. Mishom davar rotzeach v'gol adam, shnei ktuvim abayim kechad. Because the pasuk by rotzeach and by gol adam are two psukim, and two psukim that come to teach you the same thing, v'chol shnei ktuvim abayim kechad, ein melamdim. We don't learn from them. We've spoken about this in the past numerous times, but the idea is that the Torah tells you something. The Torah is not going to tell you every detail in every case in the world. So the Torah tells you something, the Torah wants you to extrapolate from that case. Use that case as a paradigm, and extrapolate from that case. But if the Torah wants to indicate a paradigm, it's going to give you only one paradigm. If the Torah already gives you two cases, then it's no longer a paradigm. The Torah is telling you that this applies to these two specific cases, and doesn't apply to other cases. So the difference between something we mentioned once in the Torah, that we look as paradigmatic. Something mentioned twice in the Torah, we look at that being the exception to the rule, and these two are the exceptions that have this principle, but we won't apply it broadly. And what the Gemara is saying over here is that you have two psukim that tell you the same thing. And since these two psukim tell you that, they are the exception to the rule, and they do not become the rule itself. The Baalei Tosafot say, even according to the one who says, Shnei Ktuvim Abayim Keachad Milamdim, there is an opinion like that, then he says that there is a third case of Erei Nidachat, that also then would say that there are three psukim that say the same thing, and everybody agrees if you have three psukim that say the same thing, that they're not paradigmatic in nature, but rather an exception to the rule. And what is that? Rotzeach hadamran. Rotzeach we already explained. Goel adam maihi. What's the story by goel adam that is similar to the case of murderer? The Tanya, goel adam yamit et harotzeach. The goel adam will put the rotzeach to death. Mitzvah be goel adam. The mitzvah is that it be done by the goel adam. So the goel adam is the primary individual who should be the one who kills a person who leaves the arei miklat, someone who had killed bishogei, and does not stay in the city of refuge, but leaves it, then the Goel Adam should be the one that kills this individual for violating the terms of his, quote-unquote, imprisonment or his punishment. So the Gemara says here, mitzvah b'Goel Adam, that the primary figure, the primary individual that should do it is the Goel Adam. Minayin shim ein lo goel, shebeitin mamidim lo goel. How do we know if there is no closest of kin that would do this on behalf of the victim? that Beit Din appoints someone to be a representative, Gol Adam. The reason to do that is to keep a fear instilled in the individual who's in the Ir Miklat, so he won't leave. How do you keep somebody in an Ir Miklat? We're not imprisoning them. They're living a normal life inside of this city of refuge. How do we ensure that the person doesn't leave the city? There has to be a fear in them from leaving the city. The fear is that there's an Gol Adam, that there is a closest of kin that will take revenge on this individual if they leave the city, or is permitted, or even possibly instructed to go ahead and kill this person. That fear keeps them in the city. That fear doesn't exist when there's no Gol Adam. So what do? Beit Din appoints somebody to be the representative Gol Adam in order to keep that fear or deterrence alive. But what you see here is that we don't take the pasuk literally. We say Gol Adam, but Gol Adam can be the real Gol Adam or an appointed Gol Adam. So now Shnemar b'figo bo, that whenever you meet him, you kill him, mikol makom, doesn't matter who does it. So you see from here that you have two psukim that teach you that we don't take the pasuk literally. But since there are two psukim teaching it, we don't take it literally, they become the exception to the rule rather than the paradigm here. There's much to say about the Gol Adam. We'll get to it when we get in the Gemara and Makot as to whether there's an obligation on the Gol Adam to do this. I mean, that's really literally a chiyuv or a mitzvah. Or reshut. It's permitted for the Gol Adam to do this. That's one question you would have to ask. And number two is, what is the necessity for the Gol Adam to be involved at all in the process? And all of those we'll deal with when we get to these situations in Sugyot in Makot. Amalei Mark Shisha, Breda Rav Chista, the Rav Ashi, Umu Lo, Bein, and Krakid Echtir, that you don't have to take psukim literally. We find other places where we take psukim very literally. Batanan. Hayam Echad Mehem Gideim O'ileim. If one of the parents is missing their arms, or unable to speak, they're mute. O'chiger, they are missing their legs. O'suma, they are blind. O'cheresh, or they are unable to hear. Enu Naseh Ben Sorer U'moreh. The individual, the child, will not be then made into a Ben Sorer U'moreh. This week's parsha. Because Shinemar v'tafsu bo, that the parents will grab a hold of him, v'lo gidmin, not parents that don't have arms, because they can't grab a hold of him. V'otziu oto, they will take him out to the Beit Din, v'lo chigrin, not parents who don't have legs to walk with. V'amru, and they will say, v'lo yomin, and not individuals who are mute. B'neinu zeh, v'lo sumin, it's our child, that they can point to the child, they can see the child, and not those that are blind. Enenu shomea bikolenu, he doesn't listen to our chastisements, to our instructions. Below charishin, and not those that are deaf, because they won't know if he's listening to what they say, if he is deaf, if they are deaf. They won't know what his response is to their instructions. So all of these preclude such parents from making the child into a ben sorer u'moreh. So as we see in this week's parsha, we take the pasuk very literally. My taima, la mishum debin and kra kedichtiv. Isn't the reason here because we take the psukim literally? It says, no. Shani hotam, over there it's different by ben sorer u'moreh, the kulei kra yateiruhu. The entire pasuk is unnecessary or extraneous. As Rashi explains over here, because davelei the mikhtav, you could have just written, v'otziu el shar ha'ir. Ha'i v'saklu, you take him out to the gate of the city and you'll stone him, like it's written by all other cases of death penalties. What is all this extra verbiage that is coming in the previous pasuk? It must be to teach us something, and that something is that we preclude certain types of parents from being able to make their child into a ben sorer u'moreh. Tashma, ein la rechov, bayir nidachat. If it doesn't have a road, ein asit ir nidachat, tivi Rabbi Shmuel. Rabbi Shmuel says you can't have it near nidachat because there's a requirement that you bring all the shlal el rechovah. You bring all their possessions into the road, and then you burn the possessions in the road. But that implies that there is a road that goes through this city. So Rabbi Shmuel says if there was no road, then you can't make it into an Irei Dachat. Rabbi Kiva Meir, Ein La Rechov, Osim La Rechov. He says that if there is no road there, we make a road, so now that we can accomplish what it's supposed to be to have that road there. So Meir says, Adkan lo pligi el demar sava rechovam demi karabina, and Rabbi Shmuel believes you need a rechov that already pre-existed the problem of Irei Dachat. Mar sava rechov adahashto anami ki demi karadami. And Rabbi Kiva believes if you have a road now, that makes it that you can accomplish whatever is needed by the Irei Dachat. But everybody agrees that you have to take the psukim literally, that we need a rechov, we need a road. Tanaehi, it is a machloke tanaim. It's not. Ein lo bohen yad, bohen regel, ozen yamanit, ein lo tara olamit. If the individual, this is a mitzora, does not have a thumb, does not have a big toe, does not have a right ear, ein lo tara olamit. Divrei Rabbi Eliezer, you can never accomplish the tara, because part of the procedures for Tahara are the requirement that you put the blood and the oil on these parts of the individual. Now Tosfot over here qualifies that and says, Kugon shenikta'a mishenizkak l'tumah. That all of these cases are cases where they were severed after he already became tamei b'tumat zarat, but not that it was prior to that. If he never had them, then it's not an issue. Whereas if it happens afterwards, then it becomes a problem. So the Tana Kama believes over here that you have to take the pasuk literally, and if you can't carry out the literal sense of the pasuk, then you can't attain tara. But lezo omer notein al mikomo v'yotze. You put it where the big toe was, where the thumb was, where the ear was, and that's okay. Rabbi Shimon Omer, notein al smalo v'yotze, you put it on the left, and that works. So both Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Lezer don't take the pasuk literally, and they say you don't have to read it exactly, you do the best you can in the circumstance. And then the Tana Kama says you got to take the pasuk literally, and based on the literal meaning of the pasuk, that will determine whether you can attain tara or not attain tara. So we see here, this is Makloket Tanaim. When you have psukim, how literally do we take the pasuk? Does it have to be done exactly like the pasuk, or it has to be done in the spirit of the pasuk? Tana Kama says it has to be done exactly. Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Shmuel are also saying something similar, which is that we take it literally. You need a road there to be on any dachat. On the other hand, Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Eliezer are saying that we do the best we can in the circumstance. We're trying to get the spirit of what's written there. You don't have to do it exactly as it is written. Okay, next Mishnah. Kol haniskalim nitlin. Anybody who is stoned is also hanged. Divrei Rabbi Eliezer. Chamimamim, enu nitle ela migadef of oved of odazara. The only people that are hanged after they are stoned is someone who cursed Chas v'shalom Hashem, or someone who worshipped avodah zarah. The Gemara will explain the difference in their opinion, what it derives from. Ha'ish tolin oto panav klapei ha'am. The man, when he is hanged, he is facing out towards the people. Ha'isha panah klapei ha'etz. On the other hand, when a woman is hanged, she is hanged facing towards the tree and not out towards the am. Divrei Rabbi Eliezer. This is the position of Rabbi Eliezer. And similar to the previous Mishnah, where we had a machloket about, was there a difference between a man and a woman? Or was a woman completely exempt from the parsha? We have a similar machloket between the Chachamim and another Tana over here, which is that Rabbi Eliezer believes that the woman is hanged, just in a different manner. The man is hanged after being stoned, but the woman is not. Amar lehem, Rabbi Eliezer, halo Shimon ben Shechtach, tala nashim b'ashkelon. Didn't Shimon ben Shechtach hang up the sorcerers, the witches, in Ashkelon? That is the story that we discussed at the end of yesterday's daf, which was brought in Rashi, the story of Shimon ben Shechtach, which again we will discuss further in the Gemara, that Shimon ben Shechtach executed these women. It says here that he hanged the woman out in public afterwards. Samarlo, shmonim nashim tala, ve'ein danim shnayim biyom echad. So the response of the Chachamim here is that this was a horat sha'ah, that this was a one-time event. Shimon ben Shechtach took the law into his own hands, because he needed to teach the people a lesson. He wanted to rid Bnei Yisrael of these witches or this sorcery or this type of practice. And therefore, he made an example out of these women. He killed them all in one day, which isn't allowed. Ain't danim shtayim biyom echad. You're not allowed to kill two people on the same day. Beit Din can't deal with two capital cases on the same day. That is because you need to look out for the schut of the individual. And you can't look out for the schuyot of two individuals. Truth is that it's only in the case where the two crimes are different or the situations are different. But it's the same crime or same situation, then whatever they're looking for one, they can look for the other, and it would not necessarily be a problem. But, nevertheless, he definitely took the law into his own hands here by executing 80 women on a single day. And the fact that he also hanged the women afterwards, again, was horat sha'ah. He wanted to teach a lesson. He wanted this to be a public event so that people would take heed from this and stop this practice. And we know that the people or the general populace was not necessarily so happy about this, because that's why they tried to take revenge by having his son be killed for what he did. And so you know there was at least some popular support or familial support for these individuals, despite the practices that they were engaged in. But they're saying back to Rabbi Lezer, don't bring up proof from Shimon ben Shechtach, because that was an unusual case. Taru Banan. So the Parshia, immediately after Ben Sorero Moreh, again, this is this week's Parsha, where it says, Ragmua kol anshei ro b'amanim v'meit, v'yarta rami kerbecha kol yisrael yishmu v'yirau. And then it says, v'chi yeh b'ish chet mishpat mavet, v'humat, v'talito otoletz. When a person is subject to a death penalty, then they should be hanged on the tree afterwards. Lo tali nivlatoletz, you shouldn't leave it over, ki kavor tik bereno b'yom ho, you have to bury him on the same day, ki kilat elukim taloi. Because it is a curse or it's a problem for God, someone who is left hanging. These are the psukim that we are darshaning. Obviously, the juxtaposition between the skila of the Ben Sorero Moreh and this parshia would then associate skila with the instructions that are being given afterwards, which is, kol niskalim nitlin. So that we understand from there. Now, the question as to how broad that instruction is will come out of the limudin that we have for between the Chachamim and Rabbi Eliezer. It says, you would think that anybody who is put to death is hanged. It is a denigration or a lack of respect for God to leave somebody hanging. Just like the one who curses Hashem is put to death by skila, so too anybody who's put to death through skila is hanged. Divrei Rabbi Eliezer. That's the position of Rabbi Eliezer in our Mishnah. The unique quality of the Mikalel is that he denies God, that he's rejected God. So too, anybody who rejects God is the one who is hanged. That is Avodah Zarah. So you have Avodah Zarah and Mikalel. So first of all, the pasuk of Kielat Elukim Taloi is being taken out of context. The real meaning of the pasuk is that if you leave the body hanging there, that is improper, or that is like a curse to God if you leave the body hanging on the tree beyond the day and don't bury them before the nightfall. The Gemara is now taking that out of context and saying, Kigalat Elukim Taloi, that only one who curses God is Taloi, is hanged. If you read the pasuk in context, you can't read it that way. It's only because they pulled it out and parsed the pasuk and leave you just that fragment of the pasuk. They're reading it as Kigalat Elukim Taloi. But that is the drasha that they have, and that's both Rabbi Lezer and the Chachamim, that only somebody who curses God, Chas V'Shalom, is subject to Tzliyah. Now we already know that someone who curses God is subject to Skilah. So now we see from that Skilah ends up with hanging afterwards. How broad is that? Rabbi Elijah says, every Skilah results in hanging. Chachamim say, no, Kielat Elukim. What's unique about those that are Mikalel God is that they are Kofer Beikar. And since they are deniers of God, only people who are deniers of God are subject to this penalty. What's another lotus in the Torah, restriction in the Torah, if a person violates it, that they're Kofer Beikar and results Skilah? That is Avodah Zarah. As opposed to something like Shabbat, or Nara Murasa, for there the stoning is not about a kofer v'ikar necessarily, and therefore they will not be subject to being hanged. Now the Gemara wants to understand, by Micah Miflege, what is the machloket here between, or the fundamental machloket here between Rabbi Lezer and the Chachamim? Rabbanan darshe klalei uprate. The Rabbanan used the school of klal uprat in order to darshan it. Tumat vitalita. That is a klal. That's a general principle. Anybody who's put to death should be hanged. Kiki lata lukim kol taloi parat. It gives you a detail. Iavu mekarvi lahadodi. If they were adjacent to each other, amrinan ein bechlala meshapaprat. You say in Rabbi Shmuel every morning, that klalu prat, ein bechlala meshapaprat. That when you have a general statement that is followed by a prat, that prat defines the klal. And that's the idea of a prat. A prat means that this is the definition of the general statement that was said before. So if it was a klalu prat written next to each other, we would say that what was meant by the klal before is that which is detailed afterwards. So, hani in, mide achrina. Lo, these items are included, nothing else. Hashta, de mirachake madadi, hane de rebuye, avodat kochavim, de domile, bechol mile. But here that they are mirachake, they are slightly distant. They are one pasuk away from each other, they're not juxtaposed to each other in the psukim. Therefore, we darshan it as basically a modified klal upratu klal. A klal upratu klal means that if you have a general statement, a detail, or numerous details, and then a general statement, da'ein danim elokeina prat, and that's what we have in Rabbi Shmuel as well, then anything that is similar to the prat is included. That's a klal uprat uklal, that anything similar to the detailed items in between, they are included. How similar they need to be is a discussion or machloket in the Gemara, where it has to be tzad achad, mishnei tzadim. Over here, because we're using what's otherwise a klal uprat, and modifying it into a klal uprat uklal, we will only include things that are exactly identical to the prat. What's exactly identical to the prat? That is Avodah Zarah, which is very similar to Kilat Elukim. If they were next to each other, the only thing that would be included would be Kilat Elukim. Now that they are slightly distanced away from each other, it turns into this modified Klalu Pratu Klal, and therefore we include anything that is exactly alike the prat. Anything that is identical to the prat, and that is Avodah Zarah, which is identical to Kilat Elukim. Blezer Darshe Ribui Umiute. On the other hand, Rabbi Eliezer darshins from the school of thought of Ribui Umiut. The school of thought of Ribui Umiut, and the key difference between them is that a Miut is exactly what it's saying. The Miut is not defining the Ribui. It's telling you that you have to exclude something. Ribui Umiut says Ribui means it's an inclusive term. Miut means it's an exclusive term. Not that there's a connection between them. When you do a Klal Uprat, There's a high connection between the two items. The klal is the general principle. The prat is the detail. The details have impact on how we read the klal. Then when you have riboy and miyut, the two have no association with each other. Each one independently is acting where you have a riboy, which is telling you include things. A miyut is telling you exclude things. So normally, when you have a riboy and a miyut, if they were juxtaposed to each other, then you would darshan a riboy and miyut has the same din as a klal uprat uchlal. It's very similar to the klal uprat uchlal. Basically, one step above the way you would darshan a klal uprat. We only include things that are similar to elikilat elukim. We are saying that they are absolutely identical to it, and therefore we would include avodat kochavim. Hashta de merachakei ma'adodi. Here, now that they are distanced from each other, ahane lerubuei shar niskalim. Then we learn it as if it's a riboy miyut riboy. A riboy miyut a riboy is riboy akol. We include everything. And the miyut comes to exclude items or one item in particular. So here a riboy would include anything. The miyut comes to tell you only by the mita of skilan, not by other mitot beitin. And so therefore the inclusion would include all niskalim to say that they are nitlin. On the other hand, when it comes to other death penalties that are executed by beitin, they would not be affected by this because they are mitmaet from the miyut. The miyut is kilat elukim. And so it's learned as a riboy, miyut, or riboy. And that explains the difference between the position of the Chachamim and Rabbi Eliezer as to what we include in the requirement to be hanged after a death penalty. According to the Chachamim, it is the equivalent of a modified klal uprat uchlal, and therefore we only include things that are similar to kilat elukim, which means that avodah zarah and kilat elukim are the two niskalim that are nitlin. The other end, Rabbi Eliezer believes that it's a riboy miyut to riboy, or a modified miyut to riboy, which means everybody is included. Any skila is included. So anybody who is stoned also is hanged. The only exception is that other mitot baked in are not included because you have a miyut that says kilat elukim. Only kilat elukim to exclude other items which don't have a similar death penalty, and that's the miyut that is created over there. I'll actually have a chart laying out these different methods of limud, and I'll send that out. And we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Mem Vav Amin Aleph.